Happy birthday, and it's today, 20 years ago, on July 27, 2002, INITS, Vienna's most important high-tech incubation program, was created.
I see it as an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Diversity matters. Yeah, mm-hmm. No matter whether it's within a single small organization like a startup, or globally and in the economy. Yeah. I simply see it as an opportunity. Yeah, there is one business idea and one founder that might not be successful in one ecosystem, but still could be successful somewhere else. So I definitely see the opportunity rather than the challenges. Yes, it's complicated, but if you have strategies to tackle those complexities, you can succeed even better.
In this episode, I'm talking with Jarene Fielke, CEO of INITS. In 20 years, INITS has been able to support over 300 high-tech startups with necessary tools for a successful and sustainable market entry. Dr. Jarene Fielke is CEO of INITS, Vienna's university business incubator, supporting entrepreneurs with R&D-based business ideas, serving all academic institutions in Vienna. She has a background in genetics and molecular biology and has worked with deep tech startups since 2004. Under her leadership, INITS was awarded 3 times by UBI Global as one of the top-ranked UBIs in the world. INITS startups have proven to be extremely successful in raising funds, 12 times the average UBI-supported startup according to UBI Global, and finding strategic partners. She personally worked with the founders of Apeptico, Blue Danube Robotics, Lexoshen, Litos, Marinomed, MySugar, and many, many more. Marinomed is the first of over 300 companies who went public in 2019, an IPO on the Vienna Stock Exchange. In collaboration with partners such as Boehringer Ingelheim, Pfizer and Unica, Dr. Fielke and her team launched the Health Hub Vienna in 2018. Health Hub Vienna is an acceleration program for international health startups with the goal to drive innovation and change in the healthcare industry in Europe. In this episode, we are talking about the success story of INITS from 2002 to 2022, the development of the startup ecosystem in Europe, the three major developments of INITS in the last 20 years, INITS vision for the coming 2 decades, female founders, and much, much more. I wish the team of INITS all the best for their birthday presentation. Keep up your great work. It has a huge positive impact on the startup ecosystem in Europe and makes a difference. Enjoy the show.
Jarene, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Ask me, I think it's 2 years, 3 years ago, isn't it?
Yeah. Time is
flying. Yeah.
Flying. I agree. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
And I'm particularly happy because I got an invitation from you where you invited to one of the first real life events in summer. It's next week. It's the INITS 20th year's anniversary, if I remember it right.
Correct.
Yeah, and that's why I thought it is a great idea to talk about INITS and the last 20 years, how the model evolved and how you shaped the ecosystem here in Vienna.
Thanks for the opportunity.
It's very great. Let me start with the first question. I mean, the first time that I heard of INITS, I think it was 2009 or 2010, in connection with Themis Bioscience. When did INITS start?
INITS was incorporated exactly coming week, 20 years ago, so to speak.
Exactly.
Exactly on 27th of July, 2002. Yeah. So 2002. That's the reason why we celebrate the 20th anniversary at our traditional summer festival. And the push really came from a program which is today called A plus B, Scale Up. It's a program that aims at helping researchers incorporate spin-offs from academic organizations and research organizations. And this is still our core business that we have run since 20 years. So it's also a celebration of ableSB Scale-Up, a program that is 20 years old. Yeah.
It's hard to imagine 20 years. I mean, 2002 was the time, I think, when companies, I mean, from the life science space, it's, I think, what was Intercell, I think, was one of the first companies that started in Austria with an, I would say, more or less academic background in life science. But up to that time, I think almost all ideas were most of the time on the academic level. So you did basically groundbreaking work with within it.
Definitely. Yeah, now Vienna really has a dynamic ecosystem. If you look today, back then, 2002, and I personally joined in 2004, there was no ecosystem.
Absolutely.
There was nothing, literally nothing. And it was really, you know, really big hurdles and issues that we had to tackle. Today, we do things completely differently because there is an ecosystem that we can work with and that we can collaborate with and that supports the founders of those businesses also from various sides, so to speak. Back then, it was Vienna Business Agency, AWS, already had programs running. You definitely remember that in the life sciences, they started a program as a first trial balloon in the life sciences, that is pre-seed. They started seed already. Now, there was a couple of things ongoing. We have a couple of, let's call it sisters, who are of the same age. Lisa Vienna also celebrates its 20th birthday this year. So there was quite something ongoing, and I believe that. But you know, after the dot-com bubble burst around 2000, there was a lot of burned grounds also that we had had spare space to build something great on.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the early 2000s, there were almost nothing here in Vienna. The first time that I got excited about life science was because of Werner Landthaler with Intercell. He did a lot of marketing to demonstrate how great the science is here in Austria and how valuable it is to create companies around. But it created in my circle of influence a lot of question marks because people didn't understand the model. I mean, how can you invest money in something that doesn't produce revenues right away? Were the question mark back then. And
but you know, the founders really, Alexander von Gabin, Max Birnstiel also, really being the first business angel investing into this. There has been a great bunch of people doing amazing things. Intercell is still alive, is now called Valneva. So that's also an exceptional story, I believe. And it was really one of the first who prepared the ground for INITS to start in 2002, I believe.
That's true. And what was the starting point in 2002? I think how did the INITS model start? What offers did you have for academic founders?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Well, basically, there was at the universities, they implemented the new legal framework for the universities. So there was also a change of university law, so to speak. Mm-hmm. The universities became owners of the intellectual property in 2004. And all this was accompanied by, in Austria, by programs like ableSB Scale-Up and INITS being the Vienna-based high-tech incubator. What they wanted to generate is on top of the tech transfer offices that are available at the universities and where just in the process of being built, some of them, for instance, at the University of Technology here in Vienna, there was a tech transfer office that was already huge back then.
Already early 2000s? Really?
Yeah. It was called Außeninstitut back then. and it was kind of the interface where the University of Technology researchers had the opportunity to go to get support in terms of getting the contracts done in collaboration with corporates, for instance. The University of Technology always had close ties with corporates, being working together in research and development with companies. And that's so they did have that infrastructure. It was kind of one of the role models in Austria in order to build those tech transfer offices. At the other universities, these were just in the process of being built. And then on top of that, INITS was created as a tech transfer externally with the focus on supporting startup creation and spin-offs and business creation. The founders of INITS thought back then, it would be a great idea to pool all the academic resources and create more deal flow and more interdisciplinarity in INITS. So INITS is responsible not only for our shareholders' universities, it's Technical University, TU Wien, but also University of Vienna. We also support all the other universities and academic research organizations here in Vienna. That's been a driving force, really. If you compare it, for instance, to Germany, there is a program that is comparable to A plus B, and they support units within a single university, usually. At INITS, I believe, is really an asset to have a great variety of universities that we are working for and with. That makes, I believe, makes it really more powerful also if it comes to business creation and creating innovative business ideas, because we have this interdisciplinary cross-border, let's call it, cross-silo collaboration intrinsically at INITS.
When I look back from what you said to the early 2000s, how did you support startups? I mean, imagine it must be fairly difficult. It must have been fairly difficult in those days. When I just think about the ecosystem, I mean, founder could go to a bank, but usually the academic founders had business models that were not in the core business of banks.
Well, they had no business model, honestly.
Yeah.
Very often. The business model is really the most difficult issue if it comes to spin-offs from academic organizations. They are very, very good in their respective technology or science, what they do. Those spin-offs, they fly if the business model really works out. Yeah? But that's also something that usually a researcher coming directly from the university never learn that. So that's exactly why INITS is helping them. We help them to create business models that can grow. And that's always been the same at INITS. We make them ready for investors. We make them ready even for the public funding ecosystem that we have, really amazing ecosystem in Austria. That's what we have done back then. What's the difference? There was, we were not as good. We also were a startup, if you could call it like that. We had to try different ways of supporting our founders. We went to pretty much every hotspot where we would think of universities creating great spin-offs. So we went to the United States, we went to the Boston area, we went to Silicon Valley, we went to Munich, we went to London. You know, we checked out how do similar incubators, academic business incubators, really support their founders and try to learn from them. We even had teachers coming over and doing our courses. But we also realized that very often they were talking about situations that we never had back then. So it was, there was kind of a dissonance sometimes. There was no fit really. What they tried to teach would be possible and valuable if you were in Silicon Valley, but not in Vienna back then. So that's how we developed our own processes. We always try to learn from others. We still keep an exchange of experience with other great and awarded business incubators across the globe. One network that we use a lot is UB Global, for instance. They really have KPIs that they measure, so to speak, in order to look over the quality of an incubator, what they can offer. And their INITS has been ranked very high, but there's all the top ranked business incubators that are awarded in this.
Let's specify very high. Let's specify very high. What are your KPIs? So
Our KPIs definitely is the success of the startups. So that's the most important KPI. We count numbers of jobs created. So how fast or how well and sustainably do they grow? That needs a lot of money. So we also count how much follow-on funding they get. We count how many female founders we have. For instance, that's become a KPI. If you look at the ecosystem across the globe, are we able to lift that potential and motivate female researchers also to take that spin-off route? So that's something that we measure. We split the follow-on funding in public funding and also private funding. If we look at our portfolio, two-thirds of the money they raise or have raised ever since in its existed is private money, and it really comes from across the globe.
So when we look at the last 20 years, I have a finance background. Can you share the numbers, the successes that you created in the 20 years in the KPIs? How many companies you founded, basically, you supported, how much money they raised, and what happened to the companies?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's too many to really talk about everyone.
I have time until tomorrow, so we can go through it.
Not me. I need to work with our startups. We have supported over 300 businesses.
300. Wow. That's impressive.
300 in the past 20 years. They were selected from about 10 times as many business ideas that we have screened, and also supported by asking critical questions, by giving them tips how to go on or also not to go on. If we can, if we consider it a high likelihood of failure, so to speak. So that's numbers in our incubation program. In the past 5 years, we started a couple of other programs. These numbers not even included in these 300.
Wow.
Those 300 have raised about $750 million of capital, not counting sales. Yeah, where I have to say this is also a KPI, most likely the most important KPI. Really, do we sell what we develop? And it's the best money that a startup ever can get. So the earlier they can sell something, the better it is. Also because they have co-funding to public funding, but because, most importantly, because it's proof that they have something that somebody is willing to pay for.
I'm very happy that you mentioned that, because sometimes I have the feeling in the startup economy, it's very often forgotten that the purpose of a company is basically satisfying customer needs, selling something, and not fundraising.
Exactly. I mean, yes, there are those businesses which really aim at selling themselves as a business. Yeah. So there are some businesses that clearly have the strategy built to sell. Yeah. And it's important to take the decision very early on, whether you want to grow a business or whether you want to grow a business to sell it. That's completely different strategies. In the end, also there, this technology must make money for the buyer, even if it's an exit. So proving that somebody is willing to pay for the innovation that is being developed in those businesses, that's definitely an important KPI. Yeah. But coming back to the former question, those 300 startups have raised about three quarters of a billion euro of money. From really starting from business angels, it's and if we add on top the public funding, it's about a billion. And so on average, we're pretty high, I believe, if we compare with other business incubators across the globe.
No, absolutely, especially since the billion occurred since 2002 and not in the last 12 months, so before inflation. So it's even more impressive because, did you ever make a calculation also including the inflation? It must be much more than, over 20 years.
We never did that, but it must be much, much more. Yeah, definitely.
It's impressive because, Austria still is a small country. Mm-hmm. And you had 300 businesses incubated, beginning in a time when entrepreneurship was fairly new. So leaving university and starting a company was not the first advice people got.
It was not the primary route of researcher, definitely not. Yeah.
And when I look at Innits now today in 2022, what offering do you have for startups today?
We offer them a one-year incubation program, talking about the A plus B scale up incubator, where we help them to really have a careful look at the scalability of the business model. That's the most important part. We connect them with everything on everybody they need, be it new team members. Sometimes we're looking for co-founders. There is a program even that is aiming at exactly building an entrepreneurial team, because sometimes the universities also have intellectual property, but there is no research that is willing or able to become an entrepreneur. So we are looking for entrepreneurs to take this piece of potential, so to speak, and make a business out of it. We also invest into our startups up to 100,000 euro.
That's great.
For a one-for-all validation. So for 10,000 euro, we take 1% of virtual shares. Virtual shares because we don't want to blow up the cap table in those businesses. So we don't want speaking rights. It's really just sharing in the losses and gains, hopefully. and this money has the advantage that it comes very fast. So the startups can decide whether they think that 10,000 euro is worth 1% of their potential gains. Then they can give us the documents to present in front of the investment board. The investment board takes place 10 days after that. And 1, 2, 3 days after that session, they can have the money on the bank account. Yeah? So that's a very quick money that is available to those high-tech startups at that very early stage. That's unusual. But speed is unusual in itself, no matter which time. But that very early stage with these high, still also technological risks, that's very valuable support for the startups also. And that's a problem that we were able to implement with the help of our shareholders and the city of Vienna, who gave us the money that we can now invest.
That's great news. I think also the terms that you mentioned are pretty much international standard when I compare it with Y Combinator, for example. The last time I read about Y Combinator was about a year ago, and they amended slightly the model, and they inject $125,000at 7% of the equity into the company. So it's pretty much similar to what you are doing.
Yeah, but in order to get into Y Combinator, usually you have to be a little bit further than the founders usually are in when they come to us. Yeah, so I do see Y Combinator as a potential follow-on partner, and that's also what they get. Yeah, if you ask our startups, the founders, they would always say what's the most valuable part about Innits is the huge network that we have built. Yeah. And it's those people we know who came into Y Combinator, so we can connect them with the person who did it, who made it. We have a lot of connections in the business angel ecosystem that has developed over the past 10 years in Vienna like crazy, I have to say. So there was no business angel visible at all when I started in 2004. But now there is really a lot, and we connect them. We connect them with potential partners, corporates who might be interesting for them because they have resources. They could, you know, sponsor them material or could invest into them also if they have corporate VCs. So that's really the issue that we give them. Yeah, they also get the mentoring, of course, as a huge and important part of that, which is one way of connecting them to those who know more, who have experienced more, and who can help them to do the right things and the things right.
I was just smiling because what you said reminded me of 2002, 3, 4, 5, 6. Today, I think everybody has a go-to place. You can open up the internet and Google where can startups go in Vienna. Then very high ranked, I believe, is Innits. You can just call Innits, go there, get the right connections, know the right people. And when I think back to 2004 or 5, when people wanted to start a company, I don't think that in Austria the term startup was used. So it was just you make a company and then you go to a bank and the bank says, with that business model, we can't fund you because you don't have one.
Yeah. Like, good luck, we had public funding instruments back then already, like AWS pre-seed, seed, FFG money that the startups could get for developing, etc. So we, I think we did a great job. The entire ecosystem, as small as it was.
Yeah. When in 2006, I was at Napriva. It was a Novartis spin-out, and initially Napriva started at the Novartis campus in the 23rd district, and then moved to Leberstrasse. It was basically across the street of the T-Mobile building and Intercell. But other than T-Mobile and Intercell, I think the entire area was pretty empty. And when I look now at this area, Innits is there, the Vienna Biocenter is there, universities are there. And how many startups do you have at the Biocenter and at Innits currently?
Well, that depends on how you count. At the Vienna Biocenter Association, there's quite a number. You can look it up on the web page, viennabiocenter.org. So you have all those, but then again, they are not, they're members, even some of them not really sitting here, but, you know, being here once in a while and also taking advantage of the network of CEOs, of experienced CEOs. We also meet on a regular basis. And then as Innits, it depends on whether we count only the program that we are running right now. That's about 20 startups that we run usually, because we have two batches that we start every year. And in every batch, we take up 8 to 10 startups. And the program is always 1 year. So we always have two batches. Yeah, one is a little bit half a year older than the other. And if you count them, it's all usually about 20. But as we also invest in our startups, you know, we are very well connected with them. We also use them as mentors. So we are really well connected with every startup. I just recently I saw a LinkedIn posting of a founder of a startup that we took up in 2004. So we are still connected with them. Yeah, it was our first exit. Yeah, it was an active in time an IT company that was bought by UC4. And he now went on to do something else. Yeah,
that's great. Congratulations. But I think back in 2004, the Initz model was alone initially. Do I remember that right? So it's you also invested very early stage. So in your model, early stage in the companies. But I think
we invested time back then.
Time, yeah.
We invested time and also money, but that was public funding. It was not what the two of us would call an investment. Yeah. So we didn't take shares. It was a kind of a public grant, a conditional grant also. So it was completely different structure. What they got from us, basically. But they always get the support, you know, the training them, helping them to pitch well, helping them to reach out to investors. Mentoring also was part of the program already starting in 2004. It was just different mentors, and there was not that many. But that was always the part of it. And they also always needed early stage funding. So we gave them that, but it was a different quality of funds that they got.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. And I think Initz is doing a great job in mentoring and also bringing people together that can tell startup founders how to present their company to the outside world, not to go with a 100-pager to the first meeting with investors, but to slice down the presentation to 10 to 15 pages. And this is also included in your program, this kind of consultancy.
Yeah, I also, you know, I would not even call it consultancy sometimes. Yeah, sometimes we are coaches, sometimes we are sparring partners. And very often the most important thing is really asking the right questions. So not necessarily having all the answers, but preparing them for, oops, that question might come. Yeah. And then, you know, we also have someone who might help them to answer the question. Sometimes it's us, and it's real consultancy. But very often it's someone from the ecosystem, a mentor, an investor that we know very well, yeah, to help them, you know, not trip into the same traps like others before. So we really use the entire ecosystem to help our startups grow and foster.
When I prepared for this episode, I thought, I mean, it would be really nice to go through every single milestone of Initz. But since you had more than 300 companies and per year now you have run 40 in your programs, and you started a lot of more initiatives than Initz in the last years, I think it would take us until tomorrow to go through for every position or every development. So let me ask you the question in a way that we talk about the three major milestones of Initz in the last 20 years. What were the three most important milestones, in your opinion, that Initz achieved?
Oh, that's a tough one.
We can also make it 5 or 10. I have time.
The first was really establish Initz in a way that we did get the A+B money several times in a row. Yeah. So we delivered the KPIs that the public funding agency, it was first FFG, now it's AWS, was really looking for. And that is, do the startups that we support grow better and develop better than those that are not incubated? And I believe that's one of the most important accomplishments. It's maybe not a milestone in the sense that there was a certain time. There was a series of milestones because the program comes in 5 years tranches. And we have to convince the public fund, you know, the ministry and the public funding agency every 5 years to really get the money. And there, that was really one of the most important milestones just right now, the last one, where Init's got A+B scale up, and really the biggest sum of all, because it's a also a competitive process where the money is split up onto different university business incubators. And I believe that we get the money because obviously it was convincing that our startups are very successful. Yeah. So it was a huge milestone. I also believe that one milestone and there was 5 years ago, the funding instrument itself changed. And we took the opportunity to launch other programs that are complementary to the core business university business incubation scale up. And that is Startkapital, so the investment. We started to invest into our startups. That was enabled by that switch in, framework, so to speak. We started.
May I ask you to interrupt with one question? How was it to change the model? How challenging was it for you to go from the old Init's model to convince all decision makers that investing in the startups is the right way forward? Because I think it wasn't it a major shift in the Init's model to go
Definitely.
From?
That was not easy, honestly. That was not easy. But we really had the backup of our shareholders and the city of Vienna, who saw the opportunity also to give startups who are spin-offs from the academic landscape to help them, get money quicker, so to speak, in Vienna, because that's still a challenge for every startup, probably everywhere in the world. Yeah, the first money is usually the toughest one. And that was an opportunity that was supported by the city of Vienna and our shareholders. So that's definitely one of the milestones. And now currently we have 10 investments that we still have shares in. We invested in over 40. Some of them, paid back the money relatively quickly because that was really one of the last push in order to make them convince private investors also. And we had our exits already. So we gained money in some. We also lost money, of course. But that's really a learning curve. That is a real huge milestone of Init's that happened in the last 5 years. And it was enabled by the structural difference, so to speak, to the first 15 years. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And then we also started to run programs that are follow-on programs to the incubation program. Mm-hmm. There we started two programs, Health Hub Vienna in 2018, mm-hmm. where we aim at supporting health tech startups to really get into the healthcare system and also help the healthcare system to change, let's call it like that. Yeah. So that's the ambition of Health Hub Vienna, where it's all about digitalization and driving the change in the healthcare system, following all those trends that we all know, digitalization, personalization, etc. And the other program is rather unique too, that is Validated Global, where we collaborate with Impact Hub Vienna, pooling their impact measurement and know-how and support know-how of social entrepreneurs with our know-how in supporting technology-driven startups and helping those to enter developing countries and markets that the future growing markets, but usually are not on the radar screen of those startups. So what we do is help them to get into, to do something like a feasibility there, We have partners, local partners that we collaborate very intensely with. They are the ones who really support the businesses to get into the ecosystem there and into the market there, because that's not something that we claim. Yeah, we don't know anything about African markets, basically. So we teamed up with partners there, who are then the local partners of the startups also. And one of the startups, they had their solution implemented in a hospital within a couple of weeks.
Yeah? Great.
Super speed. And it was possible because we teamed up with Impact Hub Vienna. That's the first thing. But also because the funding comes from Austrian Development Agency, who realized that very often they fund pilot projects, but then there's a lack of sustainability. Yeah? The pilot works well, but it still doesn't go on. Yeah? There is no more impact, ongoing impact created. And this we want to change.
These are amazing achievements within the last 20 years. So it's really great development. Especially reaching out, I think it's in Europe, I think it's still very unique that companies reach out to African nations. I always get reminded from my African friends that Africa is not a country, it's a continent. So there's a differentiation. But I think
it's not for Europe, isn't it?
but I think in Europe it's still not very usual that European companies. I mean, I always get the feeling that European companies tend to the United States on one hand, and also get more and more interested, of course, to Japan, go to Japan and China. Mm-hmm. But Africa has the continent by itself has a lot of variety and opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
How is your assessment of the African continent from the Indus perspective?
It's underestimated. That's the reason why we started the program for the startups. Yeah. Some startups might have a chance to even be faster in Africa than here. You never must underestimate the cultural difference. So definitely don't go there alone, so to speak. Ask for help. The advantage Austria also helps Austrian startups, at least, to do that and, you know, support you in connecting and learning how to behave, so to speak, what's culturally acceptable. Also interpret, you know, when something happens, why, and these kinds of things. So that's this is what I believe. Other than that, honestly, I personally don't have any experience with Africa personally. So that's the reason why we reach out to those who do, those who live there, those who know exactly what kind of problems they really have. When learning, for instance, for me, it was interesting to hear that if you think that you could make a huge business just, you know, changing anything with an easy to handle app. Yeah. Sometimes they don't even have wireless LAN capacity. So that you always have to consider the real problems that they have there. And this you can do only if you work together with partners there. And I believe that's one of the winning recipes, so to speak. Yeah. It's not that we know all the technologies and help them. We have good technologies. Some of them can help them, but we can help that also only if we have local partners that we collaborate with.
Yeah, who understands the local problems. So it's always connecting the solution with the problem. And if they have other problems, the best solution is not really helpful.
Definitely. Couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of programs that help African startups to go to Europe and the United States and also Asia. But there is the Validator Global is really exceptional in the sense that we help connecting the two ecosystem, startup ecosystem, with each other and learning with and from each other.
No, there can't never be enough connecting organizations. I guess the entire startup economy is very complex. It's very diverse, and bringing the right people together is very often, in my opinion, a game of chance and luck. So you just you can't really plan that. How do you see the complexity or the difficulties in the startup ecosystem globally from the Indus perspective?
I see it as an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
diversity matters. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No matter whether it's within a single small organization like a startup, or globally and in the economy. Yeah. I simply see it as an opportunity. Yeah. There is one business idea and one founder that might not be successful in one ecosystem, but still could be successful somewhere else. So I definitely see the opportunity rather than the challenges. Yes, it's complicated, but if you have strategies to tackle those complexities, you can succeed even better.
Yeah, I think the best strategy for countries is creating incubation programs like INITS, who bundle and bring the right people together. When we talk about...
That's in our DNA. It was there. We were born like that. Yeah, working for all the universities in Vienna. Yeah,
that's true. I think the next question I have, I think, is very difficult. No offense, you have 300 companies. Believe pretty much all are very successful in what they are doing. But given the time, can we select two or three success stories from the INITS universe? Let's call it that way. To give INITS a little bit more flash, what happens when a company goes to INITS, gets funding, gets support? What's the end point of the development? Do you have in mind two or three success stories to just exemplify for founders when they go to INITS? What can be the end result at the end of the day?
Sure. We have businesses that ran for exit very successfully, like MySugar.
MySugar was it at INITS?
Yes.
Yeah. Great.
MySugar was an app for diabetic patients to help them handle their therapy in a more easy, in a more playful way, and more efficiently. MySugar was at INITS in 2009. During the incubation period, they got an investor, one of the most famous investors in Austria, I would like to say, Hansi Hansmann, invested in the company. They also got support in terms of tackling the questions of regulatory affairs. MySugar is the first app the FDA ever approved as a medical device. So they also did groundbreaking work in regulatory affairs, so to speak, together with a governmental agency.
I absolutely agree with that.
And MySugar, pardon me?
I absolutely agree with that. Maybe we can stop it a little. I think before MySugar, the digital world was pretty much ignored by the pharma industry. So it was really challenging to convince pharma companies and investors in pharmaceutical or in drug development to look at the digital space. And then came MySugar. And I think MySugar globally was a game changer.
It was, yeah. It's an Austrian startup. And we are really, really proud of that. Mm-hmm. That is really one of the first of its kind globally. An app startup being taken over by Roche in 2017. And now if you ask the founders, it was the best thing that could happen to the technology also, because now they are active, they are being sold in 80 countries globally, which they admit they would have never managed by themselves without that support and those established sales channels also that Roche can supply. So that's one example. Another example is Spock. Spock is an app. It's a flea market app. Yeah. So you can take a picture of your old clothes or your old furniture and sell them to other on a private base. It's a startup that took over eBay at a very young age in one country. And they were also...
Spock took over eBay in one country?
No, they didn't take over. They took over in terms of business they made.
Yeah, really?
They outperformed. Spock outperformed eBay.
This is pretty impressive.
That's amazing. Yeah. And they just did it all well. Yeah. And the driving force behind was, in fact, a female founder. Mm-hmm. Ina Klaus Berger and her co-founder Armin Strubeck, he always says it was her who was the driving force, really pulling this off. So that's another example. Maybe staying in IT, Zuvu is a company who develops online sales, automated online sales assistance. They have customers globally, including huge players like Amazon or others. Wow. It's a huge business, meanwhile, still in Vienna, still growing, most likely on the path to exit. They have close to 200 people, staff members, most of them in Austria, in Vienna. So that's also a business that that was at in its very, very early. They came to us with the idea of what you would call a chatbot today. Back then it was not called chatbot, but now they have much more sophisticated AIs to support online sales. Another one, maybe Marinomate, is our first exit at the stock exchange. Mm-hmm. That's a biotech company developing antiviral therapies. They have nasal sprays on the market. Very early on, they had a product on the market because it also was registered or approved as a medical device, as a nasal spray. Another example, also big exit just recently, is Origin, a company also founded by a female founder. They develop a platform to identify antigens as targets. And the first product they proved with that the platform really works is an anti-acne therapy. So they fight serious acne. And they were taken over by Sanofi just recently. But we are also proud of, for instance, a company completely different domain, 3D printing is very strong in Austria. Litos is really one of the key players in 3D printing unusual material, let's call it like that, globally. And that's a company that is a real hidden champion. They are not built for exit so far. And they keep growing and keep pushing the 3D printing ecosystem, not only in Vienna, but everywhere in the world, really being one of the most exceptional businesses that we have had in our business incubator. But we are also in clean tech. ECOP, for instance, has a huge machine helping huge industry to be more energy efficient. So lots of examples, I believe, that are interesting.
No, exit, I couldn't agree more. I mean, exit mustn't be or should not be the end point, I think, for the founders. I think it was Brian Armstrong, the founder of Coinbase, who said that companies or founders should build companies for lasting companies for eternity, who solve problems and should not think about exits. It's more investors. It's the job of investors to think about exit, but not of founders.
Yeah. What the founders need to know at the very beginning is whether they want or don't want to build a company to grow or to sell. To sell. Because you reach out to completely different investors.
That's true.
Sources of funds, let's call it. There's something also that has developed very well in Europe by now is also corporates have started to build corporate VCs much, much more than it was 10 years ago. They become strategic investors rather to grow businesses than to not. It's not only VCs is the only. The only source of funds, of big amounts of funds. And then the businesses grow completely different and they have a completely different strategy to enter that path successfully.
I think this is an important point that you made, aligning interests. So that you should, you said, if I remember right, you said that founders should decide early on in which direction they want to go. to find the right investors and business partners. Can you expand a little bit on that thought? Why do you think as Inits, as the CEO of Inits, why aligning interests is so crucial for the success of companies?
Well, if the money or those who give the money have completely different goals than the founders, it simply doesn't work. Mm. Yeah? Because you have this continuous fight, and if one goes this way and one goes the other way or wants to drive the business into a different direction, it simply doesn't work. Yeah. Even worse, if the co-founders are not aligned in terms of where do we want to go. So that's something that the startups, the founders really must discuss very early on. Yeah. They must have strategies of when to leave and how to leave the company and let, you know, the bird fly also. Mm. If they build a company to grow, it might be that the founders stay there for quite a long time. That's a completely different story. So the money, you know, the money always is a driving force, yes, but it also has interests behind. And if you need to really align in order to get the full power onto the street.
This direction that we're going sparks my curiosity a little bit. So let me try to ask another question in that direction. You have seen with your team a few hundred companies. So 300 are in Inits, and I believe that probably when you look at your long list and all the pitch decks you get, it's probably more.
Much more.
what are the three major mistakes or three avoidable major mistakes that you and your team saw in startups that created failure at the end of the day? But where you say, if startups do that differently, they might succeed. Could you tell three mistakes, avoidable mistakes for startups that founders should be aware of?
The biggest failure of founders still is developing something that they like, but never talking to a customer, making sure that the customer likes the product.
Yeah, the falling in love with the old product is so easy.
Falling in love with your own product instead of making the customer fall in love with your product. Yeah? That's definitely one of the biggest mistakes globally, not only at Inits. That's why we focus on that question, business model, very, very early on. Yeah? Building a product, also, you know, this minimum viable product thinking is important, because with not only that you can get the customer feedback very early and prove somebody pays for it, but also you can use the customers to develop further features or more products according to the customer needs. Yeah. So that's definitely one of the key issues that makes businesses fail. And also, you know, they will have a hard time getting funding. Mm-hmm. The second is really founders' personal mistakes on the personal level. Yeah. Single founder not letting someone in as a co-founder, or several founders not aligning, and not talking honestly about what they can do on the individual level and what they can't. Being honest with each other, so to speak. Yeah, so that's really a source of a lot of failures where the team, you know, does not really work full power at their best, yeah, bringing in their best skills and buying in everything else. That's a second source. And then a third source sometimes is just the wrong timing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that also, you know, can be the wrong time for an innovation that the market is not ready yet for. Yeah, but it can also be the right time or the wrong timing, not being at the right place at the right time, where many of the founders, if you ask founders whether what was their success factors, many of them say it was luck. Yeah, and luck is you know, it's simply said, but really being at the right time, meeting the right people, being open to opportunities is definitely also something that you have. It's a skill. It's not only luck. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, I would like to add to the last point that you make about the timing. It's also patience, in my opinion, when I think about the two companies from the Init universe. Marinomed, you mentioned it, and also Temis Bioscience, I think, was at Init initially. Viral disease is a long time, but pretty much neglected by the pharma industry, in my opinion. So working on solutions for that was not very high on the priority list. And then in March 2020, due to SARS-CoV-2, obviously, the need in the pharma industry changed. So it also sometimes takes a lot of patience to stick with a game plan, push through adversity and continue developing, even when people say it's not necessary, but some things might change very quickly. And then suddenly, what you said, the company is at the right point in time, or BioNTech, for example. BioNTech started mRNA developments. It's not connected to Init, but it's an example for patients. So they started developing, I think, 2007-08 or somewhere, and invested 13, 14, 15 years in the development until they reached a point of maturity that they really could provide a solution to a very specific problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure whether I would call it patience. I would call it endurance. because you sometimes you wait too long. Yeah, sometimes, as I said, the markets are not right. And sometimes you're lucky. I mean, COVID, nobody would have wished for, definitely. But still, it opened up a lot of opportunities, and not only for vaccines, also in the digital health space. In Austria, digital health was non-existing, basically, before 2020.
Yeah.
Now, everybody felt that we need those solutions. And they also felt that how well those solutions really feel if you use them, even if there is no more urgent need, so to speak. So the market was not ready. Yeah. And this is what I mean by wrong timing. Yeah. Sometimes. Mm. You are just too early.
And I think the great thing that you are doing with your company within it is, for example, Health Hub Vienna. You started in 2017. Do I remember that right? Exactly. And focused on digital solutions in a time when, as you said, I think that there was not much. How should you call it?
Acceptance. In Europe, if you look globally, there was not many programs that. Yeah. Focused on digital health in 2018. Mm. Yeah, definitely. And now you see many, but we were definitely one of the first in Europe to launch something like Health Hub Vienna.
This leads me to the next question about Init. Init is 20 now, and I believe Init will be definitely part of the ecosystem here in Europe for a very long time. So the model works, and you produce a lot of great startups. And I hope you keep going. what's your vision for Init for the next 20 years? So maybe just imagine that we sit down in 20 years again and talk about how Init have evolved. What was the initial vision that you start now building Init towards to?
One issue that is still unsolved, there is two focus areas, so to speak. Mm-hmm. What we see is that more and more we need to uncover the potential of female founders. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at ecosystems all around the globe, females are underrepresented on the founders level, on the startup management level, on the investors level, et cetera. Yeah. Although science tells us diverse teams are much, much stronger. So basically, there is untapped potential that we need to uncover and develop. So that's part of the vision that in 20 years, we will have 50% founders. We will have 50% female investors in our ecosystem, and it will be even better. And the that equality, so to speak, is also not only an equality, but it's also using the potential of those smart ladies as we use the smartness of the smart boys. So that's part of the vision. And the other part is also more and more integrating concepts like circular economy, sustainability in its trilateral sense, yeah, taking care of the environment, taking care of social factors, and economy, really combining this in every startup, yeah, no matter whether it's biotech or clean tech. I mean, clean tech, so that's, yes, of course, yeah. But you also can consider aspects of circular economy in a biotech company. You must. In the future, if we as the globe really really want to survive in the long run, yeah, we need to take that turn, so to speak, yeah, and that's something that we are going to drive in the future, definitely.
No, we definitely want to survive. So I couldn't agree more to that statement. Let's stay a little bit with one part of the vision: female founders in life science. You always had the impression that. There is not so much a pressing problem. But just think about Emmanuel Charpentier, for example, who got the Nobel Prize for CRISPR, or Jennifer Doudna. Both run great companies, CRISPR Therapeutics and Intellia, very successfully. I mean, they drive their vision, their idea forward. And when I look at their companies, I think the teams are very inclusive. How do you see the situation in Europe currently for female founders and inclusive teams? What's the reality that you perceive within it?
Yeah, you just look at how many females have won the Nobel Prize. Yeah, they're undervalued too. So we start there. What we have seen due to the crisis, and that's COVID, yes, but also the energy crisis and the war, etc. In crisis situation, it's always a high time for entrepreneurs, but it's also a time where we fall back into old patterns. Mm-hmm. And you can measure that at many numbers. Yeah, for instance, just yesterday, there was a report about female entrepreneurship and investment in female entrepreneurs by BU Wien and Austrian startups. And they found out that if we look at the numbers, so sheer heads, yeah, how many female founders have we got, or how many startups have at least one female founder, that the number is growing. But if we look at the investment volume, it rather went down in percent. And that's something that was not yet explained in that study. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, we have, on the one hand, there is rising numbers. And what I found an impressive result, it really, if we look at ecosystem across Europe, Vienna is the best in terms of numbers of female founders. Yeah? So obviously, somehow Vienna has managed to create an ecosystem where female founders feel very welcome and are being supported and do get funding. So we are very strong in this, and that's something that we definitely need to build on. It's a strength that we have in Vienna. And, you know, in it's just one small wheel in that ecosystem, very special wheel, but a small wheel. So I believe that's something that we should and must build on. Yeah. If we look at study numbers, for instance, yeah, we as IMITS, we are dependent on whether or not females do study physics, do study mathematics, do study informatics, do study engineering, yeah, etc. And there, the numbers are also notoriously low, one has to say. We just recently, you can look it up also on the Women in Health IT site. We had an interview of, or a presentation of, the vice rector for HR and gender of the TU Wien, University of Technology Vienna. And she said that there are three studies which are notoriously low in females even starting to study. And that is engineering, electrical engineering, that is engineering, machine and bau. and that is informatics. And that's something that cannot be. So somehow we need to also push culturally. And probably that starts in kindergarten. And, you know, we all as parents, we are, have a responsibility to support our daughters in order to take the choice that they really would like, and not, you know, convince them that a normal female job is this and not that. and that's really encouraging females to go into STEM, study STEM, and then also build businesses. And that's something that is hard if in crisis situations, yeah, because there human beings tend to fall back into old patterns. And this is something that we have, that's a tough nut to crack, I believe. Yeah.
Did you mentioned, I mean, you also read it, that especially in Central Europe, women can successfully start businesses, but there seems to be something with follow-on funding. I also read on the internet some articles that said that for Series A, Series B, it seems still to be that male teams are more successful in raising money than female teams. Yeah. Interestingly, one article wrote that even when the female founders team has female VCs on board in the early stages, they are not more successful than men in raising follow-on rounds. Did you find any reasons why that is that way?
There's a lot of research being done at Babson College. They, for instance, if you look it up, Diana Project, amazing publications where they you know, dig up biases in various ways. And what they saw is that also in the United States, they compared the development of VCs and managing partners of VCs, whether they were female or male. Mm-hmm. And also the number was going down till the last publication was a couple of years ago. Yeah? So it went down. But if they looked at their investments, the likelihood of a VC having a female partner was 3 times higher to invest into teams with a female founder or the female personal management. The first round was more difficult for those teams. But then in the follow-on rounds, they had higher valuations because they grew better. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, I mean, there's lots of research that diverse teams are better. We simply neglect this, it seems. That's really untapped potential. And we need to encourage to go and build diverse teams. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we do see. Yeah, that also there is also male teams who are earnestly looking for female team members and female co-founders. So there's lots of initiatives, and slowly also the male founders start to realize that it's an asset to have a diverse team and to have this other perspective. And it's really the power of discussing it and looking at an innovation from all different kinds of perspectives that makes it successful. Yeah. One interesting point that was named yesterday as one of the reasons why there is such an equality is that female founders tend to get asked different questions than male founders. Yeah. Female founders tend to get asked questions, what do you do in order to prevent failure? Yeah? Whereas male founders tend to get asked, what do you do to really reach the full potential? Yeah? So, and there are some questions. I got asked questions that nobody would ever ask a male person, you know, if it comes in a professional environment. That's something that we also need to change. Yeah, we need to be aware of the fact that if a founder, a female founder, is just ask these kinds of what do you do to prevent failure, it comes across much more defensive rather than answering a question, how do you reach that potential? It comes across much more promising, so to speak. So there's lots of small issues that I think still need to be considered and we are not even aware of sometimes. So that's something that we need to train ourselves to be more aware of that.
I absolutely agree with that. I think, I mean, there are many good reasons why teams should be mixed, so men and women, and also I think different social backgrounds and different countries, different races should be included. When I just would need to pick one...
Ethnicities,
yeah. Pick one argument for mixed teams. It's what you mentioned before. You only understand problems when you have the people on board. So simple male or white male teams only see problems of a very small percentage of society and don't get the full picture. So they neglect basically the majority of the market globally. And they just develop a solution for a very narrow market. If the people want it, it's okay. But if they want to tackle the whole world, like Amazon did, for example, you can't solve the problems if you don't include the people in the development. You just don't see them. It's pretty easy. Yeah. It's also something that in a podcast interview, Kevin O'Leary, he's one of the investors in Shark Tank in the United States. He also got the question if he would invest in women. And he says, yes, of course he does, because it's pretty simple. Why? He said 75% of the profits he made with investments in startups in Shark Tank were led by women. So they're much better in making... They're much better in making profits than men. And this is the reason why he keeps investing in women, because they're just good at making profit.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's, I also think that, you know, there are some tendencies. Yeah. I'm the last person to really, you know, foster these kinds of black and white pictures, but there are some tendencies and females tend to question themselves more. That also means they question their own strategies more. If a female says, I can do that, usually you have more grounds to believe she really can than a male does. No offense. Yeah. But this kind of attitude, you fake it till you make it, is much more common amongst male founders than it is amongst female founders. So I always say, yeah, if a woman's stands up and says, I can do that, yeah, the likelihood that she really can is higher.
I think also in the investment world, women tend to be, because of what you mentioned, this risk aversity. I think men are less risk averse than women. It's good at times. But at the end of the day, I mean, I myself very often ask, why did I invest in that company? I mean, it was obvious right from the start. And having a conversation with women probably fixes the problem that men are just too... neglecting risks too often. So I think this would be...
I believe it's always the balance. It's the diversity again. Yeah?
Yeah.
It's only, as you said, not only male and female perspective. Yeah. But if you have both on the table, at the table, then the solution must be better. And the same is true with different origins and cultures, etc. So diversity always matters. Yeah? And it's not one or the other. It's always together. And I believe that's a concept that we need to propel and foster.
Absolutely. Irene, it's really amazing and great talking to you, and I could go on for hours, but I see that we have 10 minutes left on the call. Let me ask you, let's switch to the final question, or one of the final questions. The having a vision for a company and dreaming how the company could be in future, I think is always easy, sitting down and talking about bright and great futures. But what I see very often with founders is that they struggle with the first steps then, and to get it going. So the second and third or fourth step is always easy. But the first step is sometimes very hard to find. What is your advice to founders for the first step? What would you tell them if they come to you with the questions, how can we get going? We're just stuck. We have great ideas, but we don't know how to put them to life. What did you see with your companies? What should they do first?
Just do it. Take that first step.
Yeah.
You will learn as you go. And that's exactly what you need to do. You will not learn if you don't go. So the business idea also gets better. Try, you know, make small experiments early on. Talk to as many people as possible about what they consider a valuable service or product. Get that feedback early on. Learn early on that what you thought is wrong, and really turn into your own customer and fall in love with the customer's perspective and not with your product. And just take that first step. Yeah, you will always learn something, even if you fail. Even if you fail miserable, people get up again and try it again. And then the second time it works. And there's lots of entrepreneurs out there whose real success was not the first business, not the first try. It was not the first step of the first business. But then getting up again and you know, saying, yeah, I learned something and now I take the first step to a better business. And that's always something that that is a good idea. Yeah? But don't hesitate too much. Yeah, just take that step.
There was an interesting, building on what you said, there was an interesting thought also from Brian Armstrong in a conversation. He was asked when he decided to focus solely on Coinbase. So he started at Airbnb, was working a full-time job and built Coinbase on weekends. And there was a certain turning point where he said, okay, now I switch to the company. And his turning point was that the company already was successful, so he didn't have time for the Airbnb job. What is your advice coming from me? It's when people have a job and have an idea for a startup. What's your opinion on the right time of quitting the job? Should they commit full-time to the startup very early? Or is it something that you say that you learned that they should make differently?
There must be at least one person who commits itself, herself fully to the company early on. Because it's that driving force that the startup needs. Otherwise, you're too slow. Not necessarily every function needs to be full-time from the very first day onwards. Mm-hmm. But there must be one driving force who is committed fully to this. I do understand that, you know, sometimes you need to sort out things and it takes a couple of months. But if you don't jump into that water fully, yeah, you don't start to swim. And that's definitely something that I would suggest. Yeah.
That's true. We have 8 minutes left. Is there a specific topic that I missed on the podcast that you would like to discuss or would like to talk about at the end of this episode?
I would like to call not only for founders to take the first step, but also for investors and also us all as customers to be more open-minded. Mm. Change is something that is being driven by entrepreneurs. We need change faster. There is lots of problems. We see them. But our attitude and our habits change too slow. So be more open-minded if it comes to founding your own company, to invest into your company and into a startup, or also to buy the products of a startup, because that will really drive economic wealth in our ecosystem in Vienna particularly, but anywhere else too.
Great, great words, great words. I agree to all that you say. It's really great talking to you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks. Thanks, bye.
Have a great day. Bye-bye. Did you like the episode? Then please, please, please leave a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple and make sure that you like, comment, and share the YouTube episode. It helps that the algorithm delivers the episode to people who also benefit from it the same way than you did. Have a great day.